and when she was done he stood on his hind legs and danced, an awkward stumbling turn from the usual graceful Ben, and she gave him the beaters. I pointed out they used to go through this identical ritual when I was a kid. Ben got both damn beaters then, too. But Mom insisted it didn't prove anything, that any cat would do the same. Shannon maintained an aloof silence during all of this, only asking an occasional question, clarifying some detail, never venturing an opinion herself. Over dessert, Mom suggested a therapist she knew.
"I went," Dad said. "I had suicidal thoughts."
He popped a strawberry in his mouth.
"Not anymore."
He told us about his crisis, which as far as I could tell consisted of realizing that we all grow old and die. He acted like this would be news to us young people, though he was the one who said,
"You're only as old as you feel, right?"
Wrong. Clearly the man had forgotten Angelina. Dad now took antidepressants to make him feel good, guzzled various mood-altering teas Mom bought from websites, and he felt like a new man. I kind of missed the days Dad smoked pot in the basement and thought I didn't know while I experimented widely. I'd often speculated that some bizarre conjunction of chemicals in my body expressed in my breath and tears might have affected Ben in some inexplicable way to resurrect him. Might as well believe in fairy dust. God's will? Divine plan? Come on. He's a cat. And if he had a mission on this earth, other than enjoying himself with the least possible bother, God failed to inform him of it. "Go forth and lick both beaters, my chosen one." I don't think so.
"Maybe you're supposed to be figuring it out for me, Jeffrey," Ben said once. "You're the one who cares about this religious crap."
It was true, but I couldn't figure it out. What possible use could God have for a cat who had so little use for him? I've always wanted to believe but never quite pulled it off except for transitory spasms of awe, what most people call agnosticism. If Ben made God more likely, he also made it more likely that he's totally batshit nuts. Give me agnosticism any day. And if I wanted something to believe in, my folks always had something new to offer. This time it was some mini messianic therapist with a nimble prescription pad. My folks were almost becoming conventional. Shannon was no more interested in hearing about Dad's rebirth than I was, so we didn't linger after dessert. At the door, Mom put the therapist's number in my shirt pocket and gave it a little pat. I couldn't begin to describe how swell that felt at my age. Shannon asked one more time, holding him up as Exhibit A, snoozing in his carrier, his face and forepaws sodden from the post-whipped cream cleaning he'd given himself.
"But this does look exactly like the Benjamin you remember, right?"
"Yes, dear,"
Mom said.
"But it can't be, can it?"
She gave my shirt pocket another pat to let Shannon know she held her responsible for getting her crazy son to a therapist as soon as possible. I would sooner have gone to Dr. Diderata than any therapist my parents would have recommended. Sharon was silent all the way home to my place, staring out the window at the night streets like she was a stranger in a town feeling homesick. Every once in a while, something would snag her vision, and she'd turn and follow it like she'd never seen it before. I could only imagine what was going through her mind. How did you keep sleeping with a guy who thinks his cat is immortal? How did you let him rub your feet, make you breakfast, adore you, write you bad poetry, without doing something once the miraculous cat was out of the bag? Flee, fix it, lock me up, something. She loved me, loved my cat, even claimed to like my parents. But did she sign on for me being flat-out crazy? I couldn't imagine so. I halfway expected her to say she was going to get in her car and drive home, sleep at her place tonight, think things over, dump me tomorrow. Not Shannon. When we were inside with Ben, she kicked off her shoes, pulled him out of his carrier, and cradled him in her arms, nuzzling his face. She put her whole body into it. It was kind of erotic, actually.
"Benny boy, I wish you could talk," she said.
He just purred like there might be something to this only as old as you feel thing. Then she set him down and watched adoringly as he sauntered down the hall to the bed, where he slept every night and half the day. She poured herself a glass of wine.
"Want one?"
"Sure." She poured. A lot. She drank.
"I believe you," she said. I can't see you having some weird serial cat fetish. Showing up at all those different vets with different cats over a 20-year period is just too strange. And for what? So you could convince me now? It has to be the same cat. It has to be Ben. It's the only thing that makes any sense. Dr. Diderata thought so. Don't you think?
I couldn't believe Ben was right again. I shook my head in wonder. I did. He said he didn't. But there was something. It was like no time had passed. I was 5, I think, the first time I remember seeing Diderata with Ben. He gave me a lollipop when he gave Ben his treat, but Mom wouldn't let me eat it. Sugar was poison.
I bet you're adorable.
I was afraid you'd think I was crazy. I'd think I was crazy if I hadn't been there. She laughed, shaking her head.
It was a miracle. A blessing.
She looked me in the eye.
Have you ever tried, you know?
No. No way. Once was enough. Once has been more than sufficiently weird enough. I couldn't deal with it. At first I tried to convince myself it wasn't Ben who came back that night. But even if an identical cat who acted just like him showed up then, he'd still be 30, 210 in cat years. She made a face, unhooked her bra, and pulled it out of her sleeve. She hung it on a chair back.
I thought they changed that. That because of medical advances, it's more like 5 to 1.
150, then. Looks 20. What's the difference? He doesn't age. I can't explain it.
So he's just stayed exactly the same all these years?
Not exactly. He looks the same, but he changes, experiences new things, learns. I almost said evolves, but I stopped myself. I'd said too much already.
Like what?
She poured more wine for herself. I hadn't touched mine. Just things in general.
Give me an example. One thing he does now he didn't do when he was 17.
There were dozens of simple things I could have recounted, but I couldn't think of a single one of them. They were all blotted out by the enormous eclipsing mass of what I didn't want to say. He talks. Would I then go on to explain he's fluent in English, speaking softly in a half-whisper, like a breathy purr? Not really built for speech. It took him a while to perfect his technique. He understood what I said long before he talked back. Would I go on to explain he reads voluminously, has a passion for discussing politics, and expresses his political opinions in unique ways, like pissing and shitting on every Hummer foolish enough to park on our block? Should I then tell her the first time he met her he told me?
She's the one for you, Jeffrey.
That would have been way too Son of Sam, don't you think? Ben suggested from the beginning, and I'd always agreed with him that any mention of his linguistic abilities to anyone would be a very bad idea. And he'd never spoken clearly in the presence of others, except for a stray word or two, easily explained away as a fluke. He was convinced if word ever got out he could talk, he'd be jailed for all eternity, or until they finally carved him up to discover his secrets. He's always had a flair for the melodramatic. But I'm afraid he was right on this one. But how could I not tell her? At that moment, Ben walked back into the kitchen. He gave me the look, the same look he gave me when Dr. What's-It, who started all this with his frigging reminder card, wanted to do tests. He tells me when his box needs changing, I offered. He has a special meow. She picked up Ben and cuddled with him.
Is that right, Benny boy? To what do we owe the honor of your company?
She looked over his purring head at me.
I just realized. You've lived your whole life with him.
I wasn't sure what all she meant by that, or what it might mean to her, nor did she care to elaborate.
I'm going to bed now.
I followed her into the bedroom. She put Ben in his usual place, stepped out of her jeans and left them lying on the floor, pulled back the covers and crawled into bed beside him. She was asleep in moments, the two of them breathing in unison. I got into bed on Ben's other side. When I turned off the light, he scolded me in a soft sing-song.
You almost told her.
Oh, fuck yourself, Ben.
Neutered, remember?
He chuckled softly, enjoying his own humor, enjoying his endless life. I lay awake listening to them snore together, like an old married couple, wondering how these revelations were going to affect our lives, then drifted off. I dreamed Shannon was in a terrible accident, and I healed her. But when she woke up, she no longer spoke, not a word, and she blamed me. You could see it in her eyes, lonely and furious and afraid. In the morning, Shannon came right to the point.
Jeffrey, she said, would you help Aubrey?
Ben, returning from a crunching good time at the cat food bowl, jumped onto the sofa and flicked his tail. Careful. Shannon's younger brother, Aubrey, was in a car wreck 5 years earlier at the conclusion of a high-speed chase involving drugs, both in his person and in the trunk of the car, and he'd been in a persistent coma ever since. Until that moment, he was a mere fact of her existence from before I knew her, like the name of her childhood dog, or where she went to high school. She never went to see him. He was as good as dead. There'd be no point. Not until now. Now there'd be a point. You mean...
heal him, like you did Benjamin.
I didn't do anything to Benjamin. It was just a weird one-time thing.
How do you know? You've never tried to do it again. I can't believe you've never tried to do it again.
There was a light in her eyes that made me uncomfortable. This wasn't just about Aubrey, who everyone in her family pretty much agreed was an obnoxious little shit whose final, completely typical screw-up was not to have the good sense to die when he had the chance. Believe it. Listen, Shannon. I think this is a really bad idea.
But this is my brother. You could save him. I know you could.
Let me think about it, okay? I have to think about it.
Okay. How long do you need?
Some counselor once told impatient Shannon it was okay to ask for clear time limits, deadlines, if it would help her wait more patiently. I'd gotten used to it. She was much more patient with a deadline than without. But this was different. I hadn't been able to figure this thing out in 30 years. How it happened, why it happened, how I felt about it, anything at all. And she wanted to know how long I needed. Longer than I had, obviously. Tomorrow. Tomorrow night after dinner. I'll cook. I have a Rachel Ray recipe I want to try with that chicken.
You sure it's still okay? It's been in there a while.
I just bought it a couple of days ago. It'll be fine.
You don't think I'm being selfish for asking you to help Aubrey?
Not at all. How could asking to help somebody else be selfish?
If I wasn't thinking about how it might be hard for you, I don't want you to do anything you don't want to do, Jeffrey. I love you. You know that?
Absolutely.
Okay, then. Tomorrow, after dinner.
She sipped her coffee.
So you watch Rachel Ray every day?
She's on when I break for lunch. What can I say? She's hot. You're going to love this chicken. To tell you the truth, I couldn't remember Rachel Ray's recipe exactly, but it involved some chopped herbs and garlic and olive oil slathered on chicken parts, which were then baked. I recalled the close-up of Rachel Ray's hands, slathering breasts and thighs. She was always using her hands. I loved it. I'm a whole bird man myself, but I liked the concept. I figured baked was good, so I wouldn't be standing over the stove while we were having this discussion. I didn't expect Shannon to wait until after dinner to bring it up. My tarragon plants looked like they were up to a chicken-sized harvest, and I threw in a little white wine, some chopped mushrooms, a dash of nutmeg, some salt, lots of black pepper and crushed garlic, and, of course, extra virgin olive oil. It made a fine green goop. I decided to say no to Shannon's request that I attempt to resurrect Aubrey. Here was my reasoning. Most important, I suppose, was my gut said no. This was no surprise. It had been saying no loud and clear for 30 years now. No wavering. But with Shannon's petition, I'd been forced to rationally examine what I thought about it. In other words, to come up with some likely sounding reasons to validate my gut. If your mind doesn't work like that, more power to you. And hooray for rationalism and all of that. But for me, reason lives to serve the gut. In this case, it was persuasive as usual. First, I doubted I could do it. When Ben came back to life, I really wanted it to happen. I'd never willed anything so strongly before or since. As for Aubrey, I could try to want his resurrection because Shannon did, though she seemed to have gotten along fine without him in the time I've known her. But it wasn't happening. Deep down, I felt if Aubrey were going to make a move, it should be in the other direction. So if my will and desire had anything to do with whatever process brought Ben back to life, there was little chance of success with Aubrey. Assuming I was able to bring him back to life, the questions just began. Ben regressed from being a dying 17-year-old to, by all appearances, a 4-year-old, and had remained unchanged for 30 years and counting. Would Aubrey, who had his accident at 26, find himself a permanent 6-year-old? What effect would 5 years of unconsciousness have had on him? And as Ben pointed out, death is a necessary precondition of resurrection. Technically speaking, Aubrey wasn't dead. He was in that huge gray area known as good as dead. Even my silly father had casually described himself thus over dessert the previous night. But there's no such thing, is there? A prescription and some psychobabble away from a cure isn't dead. Nothing's as good as dead. Dead is unique. No known therapy or cure. But let's just say everything were to go perfectly. Aubrey awakens from his deep sleep a new man of sound mental faculties who lives a long, fruitful life and dies at a respectable age like the rest of us. A credit to his species, despite his previous sociopathic tendencies, having seen the light or whatever revelation the resurrected are privy to, and has been utterly transformed by the experience. Did I really want to be the guy who raised him from the dead? I wouldn't make it out of the hospital before they'd be doing tests on me, driving me out to the cemetery to see what I could really do. No thanks. I didn't know why Ben came back to life and continued to live. I hadn't a clue, until I figured that out. That's as far as it went. God might have a plan, in which case I was sure I couldn't do anything to screw it up, lacking any clear instructions otherwise. But if God had no plan, I didn't feel obliged to come up with one other than the status quo. Everyone dies. That's the way things are. Except for Ben. Would I get a chance to say all this to Shannon after she hears no? Would it matter to her? Would I lose her? That's all I cared about. I just didn't want to lose her. I knew I should care about her brother, but to me, he was an extra out of an old movie with Genevieve Bujold. I couldn't bear to lose Shannon, however. As Ben prophesied, she was the one for me. Trouble was, she had just one tiny little favor to ask, and I couldn't do it. And there she was, coming in the kitchen door with a bottle of wine, a half hour early, as I should have known she would be. And here I was with my hands dripping garlic, olive oil, and tarragon, anointing the chicken inside and out, lost in thought, re-seasoning and seasoning. If I could only manage to throw the bird in the oven before Shannon rushed straight to the issue, we could talk while it baked. She kissed my cheek, careful to avoid my slathered hands, and opened the bottle of wine, giving a half-hearted account of her day. Traffic was lighter than usual, she claimed, to explain her early arrival. I pretended to believe her. Ben, who'd showed up to observe the preparations the minute I took the chicken out of the fridge, didn't even glance her way. He was seated on a stool, eye level with his share of the bounty. The bag of innards I always gave him, liver, heart, gizzard, laid out on the cutting board, awaiting preparation once the bird was in the oven. He liked them sautéed in butter and garlic with a splash of Worcestershire. Devoured them like a lion on the veldt, if the lion had a chef. I kept the neck for making stock. I didn't treat him to such delicacies often. He liked the chow, he claimed.
I think they put something in it, he said. It's highly addictive. Perhaps some extract of catnip.
Ben's always had a serious nip habit, but we all must have our vices, I suppose. Shannon poured, laughing at Ben's rapt attention to my labors. She scratched the top of his head, and he lifted it to press against her hand, arched his back to her touch, as her hand glided firmly down his back. But his eyes never left the prize.
I hope you washed your hands, Shannon said.
She held my glass to my lips to give me a sip of wine, careful once again to avoid my glistening green hands and the oily bird.
I'll put your glass over here.
She set it on the counter out of the way and took the stool next to Ben's.
So, have you thought about Aubrey?
Damn. Of course. Let me get this in the oven first, okay? Then we can talk.
Okay.
She idly petted Ben a few strokes, growing pensive. She wrapped her hand around his tail, and he slowly pulled it through, like a napkin through a ring.
It must not be yes. If it was yes, you'd just go ahead and tell me.
As I recalled, the deadline was after dinner. I didn't count on being elbow-deep in dinner when she arrived. I'm almost done here. I just need to get this stuff off my hands and get the bird in the oven.
Why won't you do it? Can this wait 5 minutes? I suppose so. I've waited 5 years. We all have. I just can't believe you won't.
I body slammed the chicken on the counter and splattered oil and tarragon everywhere. Believe it. No. The answer is no. I don't even know if I can do anything.
You've never even tried.
She touched my oily hands. It was an eerie moment. Her ivory hand laid upon mine, as if it weren't smeared with goop, oblivious to the glops clinging to her beige silk blouse. I felt like the swamp thing. Somebody loved him too, as I recall. I looked into Shannon's eyes, and there it was again. The light. She wanted me to try out my powers more than she wanted to save her brother. Let's face it, some brothers aren't missed. But people wait their whole lives to witness a miracle. Is that what this is all about? You just want to see me do it?
Certainly not.
She almost persuaded herself. She didn't even come close to persuading me. Quite the contrary. It was too much. Years of guilt and mystery and feeling like a freak. And now the love of my life wants me to perform like a dolphin jumping through a hoop. While the saved, the eye of the storm, the miracle kitty, isn't even watching, waiting only to eat some dead bird's heart, cooked the way he likes.
It is, isn't it? It's driving you crazy.
A genuine miracle. Your boyfriend, with messianic gifts.
How cool is that? Here, you want to see?
I scooped up Ben's innards, waiting to be sautéed, and shoved them deep inside the bird, grasped its oily breasts in both hands and waggled it in her face, then held it aloft, clamping my eyes shut, filling my mind with visions of a perfect chicken pecking celestial corn or whatever it is they peck, cackling its head off. Or maybe that was me. Shannon backed away in terror, knocking over her stool. I squeezed harder, imagined more lividly, willed more forcefully.
Come on, you little fucker, live! Live! Live!
And then I felt it. A squirming, writhing, wriggling in my hands. And the bird broke loose, erupted from my grasp and hit the countertop, skittering wildly, huge drumsticks pummeling footless oiled extremities across Formica. It was amazing how fast the fucking thing could go, under the circumstances. Headless, it darted back and forth unpredictably, careening from coffee pot to toaster oven to food processor to bread machine, ricocheting off each white surface with a slimy green stripe. I lunged for it, caught a drumstick, but I couldn't hold on. It hit the floor with a sickening smack and kept running. Then, out of nowhere, an airborne Ben landed on its back, digging his claws in deep. Nothing could slip from his grasp. He opened his jaws wide and sank his fangs repeatedly into the bird's thighs and chest, tearing away huge hunks of flesh and swallowing them whole. But still, the bird struggled. The battle raged on, with the thing writhing to get free until Ben had consumed all but the bones. He stuck his head deep into the chest cavity, pulled out the still beating heart, and devoured it in one bite. There was a huge clatter behind me, and Shannon screamed again. She'd already screamed several times, as I recall. It was the stockpot lid hitting the floor. The goddamn neck was trying to leap out of the stockpot like a fish. I grabbed a long fork and harpooned it, tossing it to Ben on the floor, who polished it off in no time. No problem. I had plenty of stock in the freezer. Ben was covered in green goop, as was I. The swamp thing and his swamp cat. The floor was a slimy, glistening, extra virgin olive oil lagoon.
Dear Rachel Ray, I tried your chicken recipe and wasn't entirely pleased with the results.
I knelt down and started washing off Ben with a wet towel. He was jazzed, purring like an outboard motor, a prize fighter who'd miraculously gone the distance and defeated the champ against all the odds. Usually he preferred to clean himself, but the prize was worth any indignity. It wasn't every day he scored an entire 6-pound bird for his personal consumption. Shannon and I would have to go out for dinner, I was thinking. Or there was always takeout. I was in a tiny bit of denial. I'd been avoiding looking at her, though that must be her I heard whimpering. Finally, I looked up from my sopping, wild-eyed cat, still hyperventilating, his stuffed guts swelled out like he was pregnant. She was standing in the corner by the kitchen door, backed into the coat rack, still holding an umbrella cocked like a baseball bat. She'd picked it up when the reanimated chicken was headed right for her, before Ben leapt to the rescue. "Still want me to heal your brother?" I asked. In retrospect, not the best thing to say. She looked at the umbrella as if she had no memory of how she came to be holding it. Judging from the look of terror on her face, she remembered, perhaps too vividly, what had just happened. The bizarre battle that had raged at her feet. Two immortals in a battle to the death. Ben took a step toward her.
"It's okay, Shannon," he said. "It's dead now."
She threw down the umbrella and dashed out of the house. Her car started seconds later and roared off, tires squealing. I'd never known Shannon to drive like that.
"Don't worry," Ben said. "She'll be back."
"Yeah. What woman can resist us?" The aroma of tarragon and garlic and death hung heavy in the air. I should mop it up, I thought. But I couldn't face the prospect of reliving the moment just yet. The one for me, the love of my life, was gone. Ben had wandered off and was licking the floor. Maybe he can make himself sick licking up the residue of this disaster, I thought. But that's right. He never gets sick.
"Remember?"
"I'm going out," I announced. Ben knew not to say a word. I walked over to the barbecue place and had chicken that tasted like vinegar and smoke, fire and brimstone. I drank cheap beer and listened to a steady stream of country and western wine. Guy after guy pleading for their lovers to forgive them their sins, hanging on to enough hope to manage three chords and a catchy plea built around some outrageous conceit. But none of their desperate hope was contagious, and I remained hopeless. These guys strayed, lied, drank, whatever, typical fucked-up guy stuff. None of them had ever resurrected a 6-pound roaster as a clearly hostile act in the midst of a rational discussion. No. At some point, the weirdness has to set off deeply rooted survival alarm bells to head for the hills and not look back. I didn't know how anyone could just work around something like the ride Shannon had been on, ever since she was just trying to help and made Ben an appointment at the vet. Somehow, I knew this time, maybe for the only time, I was right and Ben was wrong. Shannon wasn't coming back. I started crying, and the manager came over to tell me I had to leave. I couldn't believe it. I ate his bad food, listened to his sad songs, whose composers would be out of work if they couldn't rhyme die, lie, and goodbye with cry, cry, cry. And now he wanted me to leave because of a few tears. I could have done a whole lot worse than tears. I had a good mind to find his walk-in and resurrect his entire inventory, set it loose in the dining room to run amok in his crappy sauce. But of course I didn't. Wouldn't. Ever again. Benjamin and a chicken. That's it. My healing career was over. All attempts to locate Shannon failed. She left town that night, apparently, and nobody ever heard from her. Nobody who would tell me, anyway. A few years later, Dad died, and Mom died the year after that. I held out some hope that Shannon might show up at their funerals, but of course she didn't. Aubrey died, unplugged by his parents, apparently. I read the notice in the paper. I lurked nearby in the cemetery, but only the parents and the preacher were there. When I came home after, even Ben finally admitted we were never seeing Shannon again.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I should never have surrendered to my predatory instincts."
"It's not your fault. You're a predator, for Christ's sake. It was my fault. I had no business bringing that chicken back to life." He nodded in somber agreement.
"True. True."
We missed her terribly, but we rarely spoke of her. It was too painful for us both. My parents had left me a modest inheritance, which I invested in the stock market. After weeks fine-tuning voice recognition software, so Ben could use the computer, I turned the portfolio over to him, and in no time he'd made us wealthy enough to retire and travel. We went everywhere. If Ben had read about it, he wanted to go there, and if he wanted to go, we usually went, and if we went, I never regretted it. We went to incredible places. We went to ordinary places, made incredible by the wonders Ben knew we'd find there. I soon discovered that if you have enough money, you can take your cat anywhere, especially when you get older. People put up with things from old people, probably figuring they haven't got too long. An old man denied his desires by some heartless gatekeeper may have missed his last chance. What sort of old age might such a heartless individual expect when it comes his time to travel about pathetically with some old cat in a carrier, when the sign clearly says no animals allowed? What, an empty building? Do you think Homo sapiens aren't animals? What then are they, I'd like to know? Oh yes, by the time I'm 84, I can take my cat anywhere. Trouble is, I'm too sick to go anymore. We've come to rest in Catemaco, a lovely town on a beautiful lake in Mexico that teems with cats and brujas, witches, and is a favorite town of ours. We've rented a place with a balcony overlooking the lake. The fishermen still fish with hand-tossed nets from small one-man boats. I like to watch them at dusk, casting their nets into water and sky the color of burnished copper. The fish are delicious, embedded with cloves of garlic and fried whole. They're only a memory to me now. I can't keep anything down. Everything tastes like ashes anyway. The doctor has come and gone. He said there's nothing to be done to save me. He could admit me to the hospital so that I might be more comfortable. But when I said I would be more comfortable here watching the fishermen with my cat, he bowed, in deference to my age, I suppose, and said he understood. Benjamin, who has befriended both cats and witches here, has returned with a woman named Hermelinda who brews teas for us both. He has broken his long silence with her, and she has agreed to come see to our needs. Will it cure me? I ask Ben of the tea she's brewing. I'm surprised I can smell it. I haven't smelled anything in a long while. I've had to give up cooking.
Of old age, Ben replies.
But I've forgotten what I just asked him. I'm afraid, I confess to my old friend.
I know, he says. Everything will be all right. I'll be joining you. Walk like an Egyptian.
He laughs at his cat humor, very sly, but I don't get it. I wonder what Hermelinda is brewing for him. Probably nip. It's always the nip with him. Hermelinda props me up in bed so that I might look out the balcony at the copper waters. The fishermen's nets like women's fans, opening and closing, leaving behind a glistening spray of memories. She holds the cup to my lips. It tastes of cloves and juniper. She patiently gives me the whole cup, sip by sip. The last sip is sweet, like honey, like roses. She sets a saucer on the floor for Ben and quietly slips out the door. Ben quickly laps up his tea and jumps onto the bed, spry as ever, pushing my frail hands apart and inserting himself once more in my grasp. I can feel him through my skin, thin as paper, his heart beating hard and steady through my fingertips.
Good night, Jeffrey.
He purrs softly, and my hands tingle. I remember the tune from so long ago, centuries in cat years. Old Blue died, and he died so hard, shook the ground in my backyard, dug his grave with a silver spade, lowered him down with links of chain. Every link I did call his name. Here, Blue, you good dog, you. Here, Blue, I'm a-coming there, too. Ben stops purring, and a moment later his heart stops, and he's gone just like that. He's tricked me. Knowing where he leads, I'll follow, fleeing the unbearable emptiness of this world without him. He's shown me the way. Some day has finally come. Everyone dies, even Ben. For me. The Puma. Theodora Goss.
Theodora Goss's short stories and poems have appeared in a variety of magazines and anthologies. Many of them are included in her short story collection, In the Forest of Forgetting, and the poetry anthology Voices from Fairyland, 2008. With Delia Sherman, she co-edited the short story anthology Interfictions. She has won the World Fantasy and Riesling Awards for her short fiction and poetry. Goss says, "As I'm sure is obvious, I was inspired by The Island of Dr. Moreau, which I was reading at the time. But I've had an interest for a while now in characters who don't get to speak. For example, the female monster who is destroyed in Frankenstein. She's absolutely crucial to the plot, but she doesn't get to say anything. The puma in The Island of Dr. Moreau is like that. She's crucial to the plot. She is, after all, the one who kills Moreau, but she never gets to say anything or achieve full humanity in Moreau's terms. She also happens to be the only important female character in the story, although in an early version there was actually a Mrs. Moreau, who was written out during the revision process. I'm particularly interested in these female characters who don't get to speak, on whose silence the story in a sense depends. If they spoke, I think the story would be different. So I like to give them a voice, to give them their own stories and see what they would have to say for themselves. I'm sure that in an obscure way I was also influenced by my favorite cat story of all time, H.P. Lovecraft's The Cats of Ulthar, which is also a revenge story and a story about how powerful cats are. My cat, for example, adds her insightful criticism by chewing on the edges of my manuscripts.
Mr. Prendick, there's a lady here to see you.
I must have jumped, because I remember my knee banging into the desk. In the years since I had moved to this obscure corner of England, where even the trains did not come and I could walk over the hills for hours without seeing a human face, I had received only one visitor, the local vicar. There must have been something in my speech, perhaps even in my face, that agitated him, because he would not stay for dinner, and he left without urging me to attend services in the small stone church where he preached, in the valley below. I was sorry to see him leave. He had seemed like a reasonable man, although his inquisitive brown eyes and pinched face, a probable indication of early poverty, reminded me of a lemur. And all that time, I had never been threatened with a visit by anything that could remotely be described as a lady.
A what?
I wondered what Mrs. Petwee meant by lady exactly. Perhaps one of the female parishioners who lived in the village that surrounded the stone church, with its post office, pub, and collection of 6 or 7 houses, coming to solicit for some missionary society to help our savage brethren.
A lady, Mr. Prendick, she...
Mrs. Pertwee hesitated.
She calls herself Mrs. Prendick.
I tripped over the chair. The next day, Mrs. Pertwee had to wash the spot where my fountain pen had sputtered on the carpet with strong soap. She was waiting for me in the parlour, a sanctuary that Mrs. Pertwee only entered to do whatever housekeepers customarily do to horsehair sofas and china ornaments. I had not used the room since renting the cottage, and had seen no need to alter it. She was heavily veiled.
"Edward," she said, "how nice to see you again."
We are divided beings. One half of me had known that it could not logically be she. The other half had known that no one else in the wide world could claim to be my wife. That other half had been right. I could not mistake her voice, almost too deep for a woman, with a resonance to it, as though she were speaking from the depth of her throat, like a viol.
"You look better than when I last saw you, on the island."
"Catherine."
"So I have a name now. Did you forget it when you wrote this?"
She held up a copy of my book. The book I should never have written, that my alienist had urged me to write.
"Did you forget that we all had names? What a terrible liar you are, Edward."
"Let me see your face," I said. The veil was disconcerting. I needed to know for certain that she really was speaking to me, that this was not some sort of hallucination. She laughed, like an ordinary woman, and lifted her veil. When I had last seen her, her face had been seamed with scars, the remnants of Moreau's work. Now her face was perfectly smooth. The high cheekbones were still there, the nose aquiline, the best, I think, that Moreau ever created. The eyes yellow and brown together, like Baltic amber. The tops of her ears were hidden by her hair. Were they still pointed? She noticed me looking, laughed again, and pulled her hair back. They looked completely human. I am a scientist, and no judge of female beauty, but she was the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen.
How did you walk with me, Edward?
She indicated the French doors, which opened onto the garden. Her gestures were unnaturally graceful.
Let's reminisce, like old friends. Eventually I'll have a favor to ask of you. But first, I'll tell you what I've been doing with myself for the last few years. Since, that is, you left me to die on the island.
I didn't leave you to die.
Didn't you?
I followed her into the garden. It was an ordinary autumn day, the sky gray above us, with clouds blowing across it, and a herd of sheep like clouds in the valley below. I could see a dog driving them, first from one side of the herd and then the other. Somewhere there was a man, and it was at his whistle that the dog ran to and fro. What dogs had done, and men had done, and sheep had done, for 100 years.
To what fate exactly did you intend to leave me?
Her voice took me back to another scene, an entirely different scene. The southern sunlight on Moreau, lying in the mud, flies crawling over his shirt, where the linen was stained red.
The puma, said Montgomery. We have to find her.
How did she do this?
I felt sick, mostly, I think, with shock. I had never, somehow, imagined that Moreau could die. Certainly not like this. He pointed to Moreau's head.
She struck him. Look, the back of his skull is smashed in. Probably with her own fetters. She must have torn them out of the wall. Damn.
As a word, it seemed completely inadequate. We followed her trail easily enough. She was heading, not toward the village of the beastmen, but toward the sea. I wondered for a moment if she might try to drown herself, as I had tried to drown myself my first few days on the island. But beastmen did not do such things. They killed others, not themselves. It took a man to do that.
There she is,
Montgomery gestured with his gun. She stood, up to her hips in the water. She looked at us, then shook herself, flinging spray from her wet hair. She walked toward us. So might Aphrodite have walked when she rose from the sea. But this was an Aphrodite with skin like gold rather than ivory, and the eyes of a beast. Everywhere, her body was covered with fresh scars.
My God, said Montgomery. So that's what he's been hiding from me.
Hiding?
For a month, he wouldn't let me go into the laboratory. He said the process was working at last. And look at her. She's his masterpiece. Poor bastard.
I killed the one with the whip, she said.
Her voice reverberated, like waves in a cavern beneath the sea.
Will you kill me for what I have done?
We will not kill you, said Montgomery. It was not right to kill him, but we will not punish you for it.
Have you gone mad?
I whispered to Montgomery. I aimed, but Montgomery caught hold of my arm.
Can't you see what he did to her?
He whispered.
The man was a brute.
It was right to kill him, and it gave me pleasure, she said.
She walked out of the sea, like a statue of burnished gold. With that unprepossessing statement, began our time with the Puma woman. Her scars faded, but they remained visible all over her face and body. She looked like a South Sea Islander, marked with cicatrices. Montgomery took her to live with us, in the enclosure. He gave her his bedroom and slept in mine. We cleaned out the laboratory, releasing whatever still had its own form, killing the results of Moreau's experiments. We had food, guns, and Maling, Montgomery's favorite beast man, to guard us at night. We planned to wait until the next supply ship came, and then... what? I assumed that we would leave the island, leaving Moreau's abominations to their own fate. But what about her? Montgomery seemed to have become particularly attached to her. She walked around the enclosure in one of his shirts, tucked into a pair of his trousers, tied at the waist with rope. She looked like a gypsy boy. She walked so quietly that I never knew, until she spoke, that she was beside me. When I launched one of the boats to go fishing, she would suddenly appear, help me push off, and leap into the boat. Montgomery would stare at us from the shore, with one hand on his gun belt. I didn't want her with me, but what was I supposed to do? Push her into the water? She would sit, silent, and stare at me with her golden brown eyes. A woman. And not a woman. No woman could have sat so still. It was Montgomery who named her Catherine.
Catherine, get it? He said. Cat in here. There's a cat in here.
He had been drinking. He watched her cross the enclosure, so lightly, so silently, that she seemed to walk on her toes. I did not like the way he looked at her. Perhaps he had initially been disgusted by the beastmen, as I had been when I landed on the island, but he had long ago grown accustomed to them. They seemed to him human and natural. I suspect that if you had set him down in the middle of London, he would have exclaimed at the deformity of the men and women who passed. She was Moreau's finest creation. Montgomery had always had his favorites among the beastmen, Maling, Septimus, Adolphus. What did he think of her? It was he who taught her to shoot, to read the books in Moreau's collection. As she learned, he answered all of her questions, first about the island, then about the world from which we had been isolated, and finally about Moreau's research. If we had been rescued then, I think he would have taken her with him. I imagined her scarred face, her long brown limbs in an English drawing room, but it seemed to me sometimes that she had a preference for my company. And sometimes at night, I would imagine her as I had first seen her, rising from the sea like Aphrodite, fresh from her kill. Once, sitting in the boat, she said to me,
Prendick, how large is your country?
Much larger than this island, but smaller than some countries.
Like India?
Yes, like India. Damn Montgomery, what has he been telling you?
That your English queen is the Empress of India. How could a country as small as yours conquer a country as large as India?
We had guns.
Ah, yes, guns.
She looked at her own complacently.
So, like on this island, it was a matter of guns and whips?
No. I tossed a fish with bright orange scales in the basket. It was a matter of civilization.
I see,
she said.
You taught them to walk upright and wear clothes and worship the English queen. I would like to see this English queen of yours. She must have a long whip.
What were the beastmen doing all this time? With the control that Moreau had exercised over them gone, they reverted to their natural behaviors. The predators formed a pack, with Nero, the hyena swine, at its head. They moved on the other side of the island. The others stayed in the village, with Gladstone, the sayer of the law, to organize what vestiges of government they retained, and Adolphus, the dog-man, to organize their defense. Septimus, the jabbering ape-man, who had been the first beast-man I had met in my initial flight from Moreau, attempted to create a new religion for them, with various big things and little things. But the others would have none of it. Montgomery thought that we should give them guns, but I refused. His sympathy for them angered me. Let them all perish, I thought, and let the earth be cleansed of Moreau's work. So we went on for several months. It was, I later realized, a period of calm between the killing of Moreau and what came after. She walked through the garden, stopping once to touch a lily with her gloved hands.
Your native English flowers,
she said,
have many admirers, but have you seen anything more beautiful than this? The original bulb was brought generations ago, from the slopes of the Himalayas. It flourishes in your English soil.
Where did you learn botany? I asked her. She did not answer, but walked ahead of me over the fields up the hill, so quickly that I had difficulty keeping up with her. At the top of the hill, we looked down on the valley, with its English village sleeping under the grey sky.
Would you like to hear what happened after you abandoned me on the island?
I nodded. I looked at her again, sidelong. What had she done to become what she was? She had a way of moving her hands when she spoke that was charming, a most Italian, although no woman could have had her fluidity of movement. Her grace was inhuman.
I lived in the cave we had shared. I kept track of the time, as you had taught me. I had a gun, but no bullets. And anyway, there were only a few of his creatures left on the island. You think that I cannot say his name, but I can. Moreau, the Beastmaster. It was burned into my brain, remember? Doubtless it will be the last word I say before I die. But that will not be for a long while yet. You wrote that the Beastmen reverted to their animal state. What a liar you are, my husband. You know that would have been an anatomical impossibility. But you do not want your English public to know that after Montgomery's death, after the supplies were gone, you feasted on men. Oh, they had the snouts of pigs, or they jabbered like apes, but they cried out as men before you shot them. Do you remember when you shot and ate Adolphus, your dog man, whom you had hunted with, and who had curled up at your feet during the night?
I looked down at the valley. She was bringing them all back, the memories. My hands were shaking. I lifted them to my mouth, as though they could help with the wave of nausea that threatened to engulf me. They were animals.
So too, if your friend Professor Huxley is right, are you an animal? As am I. You are startled. Why? Because I mentioned Huxley? I have done more things than you can imagine since I left the island. I too have taken a class with Professor Huxley, whom you describe so often. Your descriptions of his examination served me well. He thought, of course, that the questions I asked him after his lectures were theoretical. He was delighted, he told me, to find such a scientific mind in a young lady. He did not know that I had been created by a biologist. I cut my teeth, as you might say, on the biological sciences, or had my teeth cut on them.
During our time together on the island, after the death of Montgomery, I taught her about the origin and history of life on Earth. We looked at geological formations, examined and catalogued what we found in the tidal pools, or the birds that roosted on the island. There were no species native to the island higher than a sea turtle that laid its eggs there, but we studied the anatomy of the beast men we shot, discussing their peculiarities. I explained to her what Moreau had joined together, how pig had been joined to dog, or wolf had been joined to bear. I even, eloquently as I thought then, showed her what Moreau must have intended, where the beast became the man. You feasted on them too.
They were my natural prey. If I had still been the animal Montgomery bought in a market in Argentina, I would have hunted them without thought, without scruple. But I'm getting ahead of myself. For months I was alone. I reverted, not in appearance, but in behavior. I hunted at night, ripped open my prey, ate it raw. After I thought all of Moreau's creations were gone, I lived on what I could find in the tidal pools, fish when I could catch them, clams that I smashed open on the stones. I dug for turtle eggs. I was half-starved when the scorpion came. There was nothing left on the island but some rabbits and a pigman that had somehow managed to escape me, and rats that I could not catch in my weakened state. They would have devoured me eventually. It was searching for the remains of the Ipecacuanha. The captain took particular care of me. He thought I was an Englishwoman who had been captured by pirates and brutally treated. I have to thank you, Edward, for teaching me to speak so correctly. I did not realize, when I imitated your accent, that I was learning to sound like a lady. Montgomery's cruder accent would not have suited me so well. I told the captain that I had lost my memory. He took me to Tasmania, where the governor treated me kindly, and a collection was taken up for me. Imagine all those Englishmen and women donating money so that I could return home, to England. It was a great deal of money, enough for my voyage to England and a surgeon, a very good surgeon, to complete what Moreau had left undone. After the surgery I had no more money, and money is necessary in this civilized world of yours. But I found that men will pay money for the company of a beautiful woman. And I am beautiful, am I not, Edward? I should be grateful to the Beastmaster. I was his masterpiece.
She smiled, and I did not like it. Her canines were still longer than they should have been. Sometimes, when we lay together, she had bitten me. I wanted to believe she had done so by accident. But had she?
And so I began to study. In this England of yours, a woman cannot attend universities, but she can attend specific lectures. She can read at the British Museum. And if she is beautiful, she can ask as many questions as she wishes, and important men are flattered by her interest. I would venture, Edward, that I am now more knowledgeable about biology than you are. I intend to put that knowledge to use. But I need your help. I have come here.
Her hand swept to indicate the hills around us, the birds that were flying above, the clouds floating against the grey sky.
With the most vulgar of motives, I require money. You see, I have a particular project in mind. The surgeon who repaired me, who erased the scars that Moreau had left, is a Russian emigre, a Jew driven out of his country by religious persecution. How fond your species is of persecutions. For 2 years I have worked with him, learning everything he could teach me. I am now, he has been generous enough to say, even more skilled than he is. Your women who are agitating for the vote believe that they should have professions other than marriage. I, too, wish to have a profession. I propose to follow in my father's footsteps and become a vivisector.
I stared at her, gazing over the hills, with the wind whipping her skirts back and tossing her veil. She looked like the figurehead on the prow of a ship. But where was she headed? Moreau's work had brought us once to disaster. Was she now truly planning to continue what he had begun? After his death, the more peaceable beastmen had developed the habit of coming to the enclosure to trade what they grew in their gardens for our flour and salt. Twice a week they came, crowding into the enclosure, like an English market crossed with a menagerie, or a Renaissance painting of some level of Dante's Inferno. Montgomery should have noticed that Nero and the wolf-bear Tiberius had entered the enclosure. Maling should have been guarding the gate, but his attention was elsewhere. The beastmen had begun adopting our vices, for which Montgomery was in no small measure to blame. He had taught them the use of tobacco, which he traded for food, and to pass the time he had whittled a pair of dice, with which they gambled for onions, turtle eggs, whatever the beastmen had brought to trade. That morning, Maling was gambling with the beastmen.
"Why does she carry a whip?"
I heard the shout, and went to the window. I usually avoided these market days. I still found it disconcerting to be in the company of so many of Moreau's creations. Montgomery stood by the door of the storeroom, which held our barrels of tobacco, flour, biscuits, salted meat. Next to him stood Catherine, dressed as he was, with a gun in her holster and a whip tucked into her belt. All around stood the beastmen with the goods that they had brought, and in the back, close to the gate, stood the hyena swine.
"She is one of us, one of the maid. Why does she carry a gun? Why does she carry a whip? Let her join her own people."
The beastmen stood, staring, and I could see the inquisitive look in their eyes.
"Why does she not come to us?" said Catullus, the satyr. "We have few females. Why does she not come to live in our huts and work in our gardens like the other females?"
"Yes," said the ape-man. "Let her live with us. With us. With us. She can be my mate."
Then others spoke and said that she could be their mate as well. I could see Montgomery looking puzzled. He had been up late drinking the night before and was still nursing a hangover. He could not understand this rebellion among the usually peaceable beastmen. From where he stood, he could not see the hyena swine. I could see Catherine's hand on her gun. The beastmen began arguing among themselves, each claiming her. Moreau had never made enough beast women, and they were constantly trying to lure the ones they had away from each other. One pushed another. Soon there would be a fight. I stepped through the doorway into the enclosure.
"The master, who has gone to live among the stars and watches you from above, has intended her for another purpose. She will not be any of your mates. She will be without a mate, but will bear a child that will perpetuate your race. That is the purpose for which he has created her. She will be the mother of a new race of men. Bow to her, who is dedicated to such a high purpose."
They stared at me.
"Bow," I said, raising my gun.
I could see the hyena swine slinking through the gate. One by one, reluctantly, they inclined their heads.
"Hail to the Holy Mother," said the ape man. He had always been sillier than the rest.
"Well then," I said, "you may continue to trade. There will be no punishment today, despite your disobedience."
That night, Montgomery lit the bonfire. He lit it every night. If there was a ship sailing within sight of the island, we did not want it to miss us. Sometimes the beastmen came and danced by the light of the bonfire.
"A regular corroboree," Montgomery called it. "Catherine," he called, after the fire was lit.
I could see him standing in the enclosure, with the full moon behind him, larger than it ever is in England.
"Come to the dance. There's a regular crowd of them tonight."
"Not tonight," she answered. "Tonight I wish to speak with Edward."
"Damn Edward. Come on, Catherine."
I realized that he had already started drinking, or perhaps had never stopped. I did not hear her answer, but he shouted,
"All right then, damn you."
And then I heard the gate crash shut.
"He's gone," she said a moment later,
standing in my doorway. What did you want to speak to me about? She came closer. She had a smell about her. Not unpleasant, but particularly, I thought, feline.
Do you think he had a purpose for me?
Who?
Moreau. You can see that I'm made differently from the others. My hands. He must have taken particular care.
Her hands were on my shoulders. I could feel her claws through my shirt.
Am I not well made, Edward?
I looked down into her eyes, dark in the darkness. I don't know what possessed me. You are divinely made. Where my shirt was open, she licked my chest, then my neck. She was almost as tall as I was. I could not help remembering Moreau's neck, torn open. He had done his work well. Standing on an English hillside, watching her with her veil blown back by the wind, I shuddered at the memory of her brown thighs, with a down on them softer than the hair of any woman. She smiled at me, and despite my sweater and Macintosh, I felt cold. We were lying together in a tangle of sheets when we heard the shot.
Get your gun, she said.
We ran out, me in my trousers, she in a Montgomery shirt. As we passed the storeroom, she disappeared suddenly, then reappeared with an ammunition belt over her shoulder. On the beach, around the bonfire, beast men were dancing. There was a throb in the air, and after a moment I realized that it was a drum. Someone, it looked like the Sayer of the Law, was keeping time while the beast men turned and leaped and shook their hands in the air and shouted each in his own way, some like the grunting of a pig, some like the barking of a dog, one caterwauling. I will never forget that sight, watching from the shadowed dunes while the beast men capered together and the puma woman stood with her gun in her hand, the ammunition belt slung over her shoulder at my side.
The fire is larger tonight, she said. What are they burning?
I looked again, more carefully.
The boats.
They had not been large enough to carry us away from the island, but they had at least been tangible signs that escape was possible. Without thinking, I ran among them. Damn you to hell! Damn you all to hell! What beast among you? One of the beast men turned toward me. I started back with a cry. He was wearing a mask that made him look like a gorilla, but the eyes behind it were Montgomery's. The other beast men stopped, stumbled into one another in confusion.
What the hell? I'm the gorilla man, see?
He began to caper about with the stooping gait, the hanging arms of a gorilla. The other beast men laughed. I could see the firelight on their teeth.
Drunk. You're all drunk. It's disgusting. Come on, old stick-in-the-mud Prindick. Old hypocrite Prindick. Having your fun with the cat. I deserve some fun too, don't you think?
Come on, Montgomery, I said. I tried to grab him, but he swung at me, punching me in the mouth. He could have hit harder had he not lost his balance, but I tasted blood. And then I saw a gleaming pair of eyes, and then another, staring at me. The wolf bear was there, as was the hyena swine, and with the instinctive reaction of a predator, the hyena swine leaped at me. I heard a crack. The hyena swine fell at my feet. Then another crack, and another, and more beast men fell. They began screaming, running toward the darkness of the jungle. I thought I would be deafened by the cacophony, or crushed as they ran. But the last of them vanished into the jungle, and suddenly there was silence. I was still standing, alone. At my feet lay the body of the hyena swine. Beyond him lay Maling, a wolf woman, one of the pigmen, and the gorilla man, Montgomery. You killed him, I said.
He became one of them,
she said, out of the darkness. I did not answer. Silently I turned, intending to walk back to the enclosure. It was a mass of flames. I heard a scream that I thought might come from one of the beast men, until I realized that I was the one screaming. For the second time that night I began to run. We saved nothing. There was nothing left to save. We had lost our supplies, and worse, we had lost the rest of our bullets. After the ones that Catherine had taken ran out, our guns would be useless.
One of us must have overturned the lamp, she said.
She was, as always, perfectly calm. The only evidence I had seen of her anger had been Moreau's throat, or what was left of it.
What could I say to her?
If I had overturned the lamp, it had been by accident. But she, so agile. Could she have done it deliberately? I hated her then, more than I had hated Moreau. If I thought I could have, I would have killed her. But I did not want to die Moreau's death, to be buried or worse, on that island of beasts that looked like men. When I remember it now, I realize that I must have overturned the lamp. Montgomery had burned the boats to revenge himself upon me, but she had no use for revenge. Her motives were always simple, logical. What she wanted, she obtained directly, not with human indirection. Although she looked and laughed at me like an English lady, she still thought with the mind of a beast. And so began the longer part of our stay on the island. Montgomery's body we burned, but the other bodies. She was a predator, and slowly, unwillingly, I fell in with her ways. We hunted together, and with practice my vision became keener, although never, of course, equal to hers. I insisted on cooking our food, although she laughed at me. I would not watch her when she ate it fresh from the kill. We drank from the stream, sucking the water up. Our clothes grew ragged and hung on our brown hides. I lay with her in the cave we called our home, hating her, hating what I had become, but unable to leave her. Even now, I remember her touch, the rasp of her tongue on my skin, the gold of her eyes as she stared down at me and said, "What are you thinking, ape-man?" "Don't call me that." She would laugh and push her nose against me, like a cat that wants to be stroked, and made a sound in her throat that was neither a purr nor a growl. One day I was walking along the beach, scavenging what I could, crabs, clams, seaweed. We were using our bullets judiciously, but they were beginning to run out. Soon we would be reduced to hunting like beasts. I would become like her. I saw something floating toward me. A sail. But the boat reeled like a drunken sailor. It was the boat I have described in my book, with the captain and the first mate of the Ipecacuanha sitting aboard, dead. This might be my only chance to escape the island. If I died on the ocean, at least I died as a man. I stepped into the boat. I was certain then that I would never see her again. "Perhaps," she said, "you would like to know in what way you can help me." A light rain had begun. Her veil caught drops of moisture, like a spider's web. I turned away. I did not want to know, and yet I could not stop listening. As a scientist and a man, I wanted to know what she intended.
"I would have liked to bear children myself, but I cannot. You and I proved that, did we not, Edward? Would you have liked that, to have had children with me? What would they have been like, I wonder? Moreau took away my ability to breed with my kind, and could not give me the ability to breed with yours. Even Dr. Radzinski was not able to give me that, although he tried. Somewhere, there is an incompatibility that goes beyond the anatomical. Perhaps someday your scientists will find it, and then we will be able to create a true race of beast men. But I am impatient. I want my children to flourish and populate the earth. Surely a natural desire, according to Mr. Darwin. Here, in England, I will create a clinic to revive and perfect Moreau's research. But my clinic will be no house of pain. We will incorporate all the technological advances of the last decade, and the educational advances, since my clinic will also be a school. Think, Edward, my children will be educated along the latest scientific lines, educated to be the inheritors of a new age.
What makes you think that I would finance such a mad scheme? Is it not enough that Moreau did it once? Why would you wish to create such abominations yourself?
Not abominations. Look at me, Edward. Am I an abomination?
I did not know how to answer.
You will finance my mad scheme, as you call it, for three reasons. First, because you are a gentleman, and a gentleman cares about his reputation. If you do not provide me with the financing I require, I will inform your English press. There are two laws, Edward, that all civilized men obey. Not to lie with their mothers or sisters or daughters, and not to eat the flesh of other men. You have broken the second of those laws.
Why should I care what the public thinks of me?
Because there will be inquiries, and because nothing will be proven. People will think the worst. You will become notorious. Wherever you go, people will follow you, to interview you, to take photographs. Imagine the newspapers. what Mr. Prindick the cannibal had for breakfast, how it compares with human flesh. But second, you are a scientist. What I am proposing is an experiment. I will bring pumas from the Americas, young ones, less than 2 years old, fine, healthy specimens. I will operate on them in stages, changing them gradually, allowing them at each stage to become accustomed to their new forms, educating them. There will be no pain. There will be no deformity. My children will be as beautiful as I am.
I grasped at straws. Your plan is impossible. You will never be able to build a clinic like that in England. Where would you hide? There is no part of the countryside that is uninhabited, no place obscure enough that your work won't be observed. You will be found out. She laughed.
I do not propose to put my clinic in the countryside. No, my clinic will be in the heart of England, in London itself.
But surely the police?
There are parts of London where the police never go. Parts where the inhabitants speak a babble of language, and everything you want to purchase is to be had. From a girl, fresh from the English countryside, to a pipe of opium that will give you distinctly un-English dreams. I have become familiar with them over the last few years. Do not worry about the practicalities. Those I have thought of already. And third, I did tell you there are three reasons. You are a follower of Mr. Darwin. Consider, Edward.
She turned again to look at the valley below.
The operation of natural selection is necessary for evolution. Without selective pressure, a species stagnates, perhaps even degenerates, reverting to atavistic forms. How long has it been since selective pressure operated on the human species? You have killed all your predators. How many men are killed by wolves or bears in Europe? You care for your poor, your sick, your idiots, your mad, who give birth to more of their kind, filling your cities. Your intelligent classes, who spend so much of their energy in their work, do not breed. This is not new to you, I know. You have read it in Noadow, Lombroso. Your very strength and compassion as a species will be your undoing. You will grow weaker by the year, the decade, the century. Eventually, like the dodo, you will become extinct. That is the fate of mankind unless...
Unless what?
You once again introduce a predator. That is what I'm offering you, Edward. Selective predation. A species that I create to feed off the weakest among you. To make humanity strong.
She was mad, I thought, and I think so still. But there is a kind of reason in madness. Moreau had it, and as she claimed, she was Moreau's daughter. He too had the directness, the simplicity of a beast. I have not seen her since that day on the hillside. The money I send her is deposited into a bank account, and where it goes from there, I do not know. Do I believe that the creatures she creates will strengthen rather than weaken mankind? I do not know. But she has never lied to me. It takes a man to do that. There was a fourth reason that she did not mention. Perhaps it was kindness on her part not to mention it. But I do not think that, in all her interactions with men, she has learned kindness. Surely she must have known. Sometimes at night I still think of her, her fingers twining in my hair, her legs tangled in mine, her lips close, so close, to my throat. I do not think I loved her. But it was a madness that resembled love. And perhaps I am still mad, because I have not refused her. She must have known, because as she stood in the doorway, ready to depart, as respectable as any English lady, she stepped close to me and licked my neck. I felt the rasp of her tongue.
"Goodbye, Edward," she said. "When I am ready, not before, I will invite you to my clinic, and you can see the first of our children. Yours and mine."
Yesterday, in the post, I received her invitation. Will I go? I have not decided. But I am a scientist, cursed with curiosity. I would like to see what she creates, and whether she is indeed a worthy successor to Moreau. Editor's note. I hesitate to publish this manuscript, left to me by my late uncle Edward Prindick, because credulous members of the public may connect it with this series of brutal murders that is currently taxing the ingenuity of Scotland Yard. However, Professor Huxley, my uncle's former teacher, has asked me to publish it as an addendum to my uncle's manuscript of his time on the island.
I believe the conversation it records was a hallucination. It must be remembered that my uncle's health was severely affected by the shipwreck that left him the sole inhabitant of an island in the South Seas, and at that time of his death, he was attended by an alienist. I am satisfied that the cause of his death was natural. Heart failure can strike a comparatively young man, and even if we give no credence to the fantastical occurrences that he claimed to have witnessed, my uncle must have suffered a great deal. It is true that upon the execution of his will, his fortune was found to be significantly diminished. However, there are a number of possible explanations for the state of his affairs, and we should not draw conclusions before the investigation into his death is complete. I hope the public will do justice to the memory of my uncle, who, although disturbed in mind, was a man of intellectual promise before the shipwreck that embittered him toward mankind. And I hope the public will dismiss the ridiculous fancies of Fleet Street and assist our police in catching the perpetrator of the Limehouse murders. Charles Prendick.
This has been an Audible Frontiers production of Tales of Wonder and Imagination, written by Stephen King, Neil Gaiman, George R.R. Martin, Joyce Carol Oates, Susanna Clarke, Lawrence Block, Tanith Lee, Peter S. Beagle, Graham Joyce, John Crowley, Charles DeLint, Ellen Datlow, editor. Narrated by Teresa DeBerry, Jeremy Arthur, and Cynthia Barrett. Producer Mike Charzik. Copyright 2010 by Ellen Datlow. Production copyright 2013 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.